Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Marcia Cook, and it's A Good Story is a Good Story, and it is going to be a great show today. Our guest is going to be a little late. He got tied up, but he'll be here soon. And we have Fran Lewis and Sandra Elrod here, my buddies. Thank goodness we have them all. Yeah, Gerard is here anyway. All right, anyway, we're going to have a great show today. It's an hour show, and it's going to be the usual Good Story is a Good Story, but we have Fran here, and Fran is the great book reviewer that always comes on and talks about certain books, and she has her own show, which is actually on Tuesday. Hi, Fran, come out. You can talk for a second. Hi, Fran.
I'm here.
Okay, Fran, tell everybody who we have on Tuesday so what we don't not say this.
Well, for those of you that love murder and mystery, love the Sisters of Crime, and love V.W.I. Wojciechowski, Sarah Paretsky is going to be joining myself and Marcia and Sandra on Tuesday, 6:30 Eastern, 5:30 Central, 4:30 Pacific, and I don't know about the mountain time, but it's going to be really interesting. We're going to talk to Sarah Paretsky. I'm going to talk to her about her book, and Marcia's going to talk to her about publishing and Sisters of Crime and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, the Sisters of Crime were on my show. Yeah, they were on my show. And Sandra, you were on that show, right? We did that 2 weeks ago. They were great. They were really fun. And that is quite a group that she started, because it's all over. It's the whole United States, so it's really good, and they're fun, you know. And she started it. I actually met her. She's from Chicago, and that would be good to have somebody from Chicago. I don't think we ever have anybody from Chicago that much. Not too many people. Well, it's a busy place here, but I don't know. They're not coming up. Maybe they're not writers as much, but they are. So Sarah's going to be here, and that's going to be a fun show. Okay, shall we talk about our guest that's on, who is not really a new guest for us, because Fran has had him on, and I've had him on. I'm probably going to name wrong, even though I've got it written in every way. Okay, this is Gerard De Marini. Hi, Gerard. Did I say it wrong?
No, you said it right, Marcia.
Oh. Good. Don't ask me to do it again. It's really good. I'm so proud of myself.
You know, I hate to apologize. You know, John Wayne used to say it's a sign of weakness in men, and you know, I come from a John Wayne type family. But you know what, Marcia and I just talked 2 days ago about how frantic you can become being a radio host and not having your guest, you know, appear,
very good at it. We're getting good at it now. It's okay.
Well, normally I'm very tactful, but,
we
do homeschool our four boys, and my wife and I, we're tag-teaming them. We actually start very early here in Las Vegas, and they had something that they had to go to, and I really didn't think we were going to have any traffic, and we hit traffic, and I was about to call in from the car, but I made it home, so
that's okay.
There
so
it is.
Virginia and I have done we do shows together, and she's the other half of the World of Ink. She was at, I think she was at Kmart or Walmart. We did a show. She was there. She was late, and we did a show from there. Okay, so it's nothing new for me to have shows somewhere.
It's the best
way. She also did a show in the car going to California.
It's
so
the best laid plans of mice and men, you know. You just say to yourself, you know what, I have an hour to drive 20 minutes, so there's no problem. And then when it gets up to 58 minutes, you start saying, I might have a problem. I hope the garage door opens so that I can get in.
Yeah, honestly, because that's what me, I go like, this is 5 minutes. And I even with my screenplays, it'll take me a week, and that's like 5 months later, because I always think everything is fast. I could do it faster than we can. But so we're so happy to have you here. And Sandra's here in the chat room. She said there are people in the chat room. And actually, we are featured. We are a featured show today, so that's a good thing. We're being featured a lot, because I've been doing shows like every day for 2 weeks practically. But I know. And Fran, do you want to, I think, you know, Fran read his book and did a great review, as always, and I actually am reading his book, and it is a really good book. I mean, you are a great writer, and I can tell that, like, even the, you know, I really know you're a good writer, and that's why I say it a lot, but I have read hundreds of books, and I have people always sending me things, but your work is spectacular, and you are a really good writer. And so, Fran, do you want to talk about his old book for just a sec, his other book, and then his new book, and then we'll talk to, you know, then we'll talk about a lot of things. And also, we're going to talk now that your boys are homeschooled. That's an interesting subject, so we'll talk about that, too. We'll have that in. I didn't know that. You didn't say that. Okay, we never said that. All right, Fran, go ahead.
Hi there, Gerard. It's me. How you doing?
Very good, Fran. Very good. Great to talk to you again.
Yeah, well, we've got tons of people in the chat room over there that probably have a million questions. But since I read The Watchmen, you want to give everybody just a brief summary. But before I do that, I have to read what you wrote. Okay, Signs of War, the sequel to number one Amazon best-selling geopolitical thriller, The Watchmen of Ephraim. Yes, and I am very proud to say that I reviewed that book, and it was really good. So can you just give everybody, like, a brief summary of the first one before we get into the second one so everybody knows some background about my favorite character, Chris?
And I also added on my website, you know, actually on my Facebook, I added your video. You have, the video that you have?
Oh, excellent.
I just added that today. I hope it shared. Right. Okay. Go ahead.
The Watchmen of Ephraim is about a story about a hedge fund manager, a guy that grew up in Brooklyn and became very successful running a hedge fund, which my background brought me into the financial industry. It was one of the reasons why I grew up with a crowd of people from basically an immigrant neighborhood, a place called Ridgewood, New York. And my friends, I'm very proud of all of them. Not Harvard-educated people, very street smart, became commodity traders, ran private equity companies, and just kind of street smart, New York street smart, and they became very, very successful. And some of the experiences that I had with that inspired me to write about Chris De Niro, which was the second part of it is 9/11. September 11th came, and we lost a lot of friends in the World Trade Center. So putting those two things together inspired me to write a story about a man who became very successful and lost his wife in the North Tower of the World Trade Center, which is where my wife and I lost a very dear friend. And I wanted to do was, I love writing, and I was a big Tom Clancy and W.E.B. Griffin fan for a lot of years, and I wanted to write a thriller that had the protagonist to have the kind of the hero character, not a special forces guy or a military guy. I wanted to have a really upset, emotional American who lost who lost a family member. There was so much of that back in September 11th, and so I made Chris kind of the model for all of them to kind of vent some of the frustration and say, hey, this is a guy that can actually do something. The rest of us couldn't. And so that's where Chris was born, and that's where the story was born. And he ends up starting a counterterrorism firm, and that's the basis for the entire series.
Okay, that sort of says it. Signs of War is very different, I have to tell you. There's like three separate plots in Signs of War, correct? You have three different
yes.
different themes going. So I got it. Not bad. And it took me a while, and I said, okay, I've got to read this a couple of times to make sure that I had everything right.
And Fran, what I said today, Fran, is true, though. But see, in this book, what you did is you explained what happened so we can understand it if you didn't read your first book.
Right.
So people
yeah,
ask him.
You've got a lot of backstory there. He's got
yeah,
a lot of backstory there,
no,
which
that's
helps.
That's a good thing, because in case they haven't read the first one, they'll at least understand what it was about. Go ahead.
Well, they should read both of them anyway. That's beside the point.
Yeah, it is.
But you should get them on Barnes & Noble, not Amazon, because they deliver faster.
Okay.
What made you choose this plot line involving Iran and Venezuela forming an alliance against the United States? Because that's plot number one.
Well, the series, my whole concept for the series was to take current events and drop the characters into the current events right now. So it's just something that I particularly love to read about, and taking these characters and letting them react to what's going on today just seemed to be very exciting to me. So the Venezuelan-Iranian situation was actually something that had has been materializing over the last couple of years. So it's a real event. All of the events that happen mm-hmm. in the Chris De Niro series are real events, and I dramatize as little as I can so that it really comes alive as a real, in a real experience.
I agree with you because I felt like I was right there sometimes.
Yeah.
With everything. Now the other two plots, you see, I have it written down so I didn't forget. You had two other subplots. One was the drug cartel, and one was a kidnapping of the Somali pirates. How come you included those two also? And there were other characters that became and played.
Again, Fran, that's what's happening right now, and that's when I get a lot of news feeds, and just like anybody else, I guess, and you watch the news, and you know, life is coming at us so quickly nowadays, where we don't have just one event or two events. I mean, these things are happening. The Venezuelan-Iranian connection was, when I started reading about it, it was just a news article, and I was like, wow, that's kind of scary. Mid-range missiles being set in South America, supposedly pointed at Colombia, but honestly, they could easily reach the continental United States. So that story came about, and then I got I actually get upset. I read about a story about an older married couple that were kidnapped by Somali pirates, and it ended very badly, where the American fleet were coming after them, and the Somali pirates they became frantic, and they ended up killing these people. And that's the kind of frustration that inspired me to write about the 9/11 tragedy. So those are the kind of, and then honestly, what's going on at the Mexico right now is mm-hmm. absolutely
yeah.
very close to chaos. So
yeah.
Now, I live in Las Vegas, so we're very, when I lived in New York, Mexico is like a world away, but when you live here, I'm a couple hundred miles away from the border, so it's kind of an intense situation here,
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, you lost a character, one of my favorite characters in the other book, Charlie, right? He dies whatever happens at the end of the book. So who is this man in black who I think is really cool? And why did Chris choose him to replace Charlie?
His name is Scipio, and I just had a conversation
really
about
cool.
Scipio. Well, he's not Charlie Santapia. The character that he replaces is the character from the first book, and Charlie Santapia was a Marine. He was, and a lot of these guys were military types. So Chris De Niro is actually not a military guy, but he's surrounded with his brother-in-law and others that are military types. I didn't want to rewrite the character with just another name. I wanted to have a different influence. And the Scipio character was actually something that's been in my mind for a while to write a standalone book. Just kind of a fascinating guy, a guy that I'm used to. Again, coming from Brooklyn, I've seen some of the scariest people that I've ever known, the most intimidating people I've ever known, are not the big, Worldwide Wrestling Federation guys. They're actually the quiet guy that you probably don't even realize is in the room, And that just fascinated me at how some people can just kind of carry intimidation without physical size or anything else. And that enter Scipio. Scipio is a guy that I wrote as being part of the Delta Forces, which is a very unusual part of the military. They're actually as unmilitary as you can possibly be, because they're doing a lot of reconnaissance operations and things. So they don't wear uniforms. They can grow their hair long or whatever. And Scipio, I thought it would be a great addition to take a guy he's really doesn't have the convictions and the passions of the rest of the people in The Watchmen or Chris De Niro. And so, but he is at his core a righteous guy. And that's why Chris De Niro would even, let him into their little family.
Yeah, he was really cool. I got, what got me was that Chris, runs the Watchmen himself. So I was curious as to why he allowed him to give him all of his conditions, and he allowed him to run the operations his way. So he became the head of Archangel, right?
As part of the vice president.
He became Archangel, right?
Right. He's in the Watchmen. Archangel was actually a covert paramilitary arm, which a lot of counterterrorism firms have a little small paramilitary arm that can take care of the actual on the ground, boots on the ground things. So he, as part of his role as VP of operations of the Watchman, they put him in charge of that. He's not really a guy that's made for management, you know, as opposed to Charlie Santapia, who was a VP and came out of the Marine Corps. You know, this is a fella that's used to working on his own. So that's another little twist to the character.
Yeah, because usually they have to check with Chris, and they have to do this as a team. And he's sort of like so cool, this guy. You are going to bring him back, I hope.
Are you talking about Scipio?
Yeah.
Scipio's now part of the family, and it's funny when, you know, as you write these things, the characters start having fans of their own, and not everybody's a Chris De Niro fan. I mean, people like Chris De Niro, but some people like the different characters, and Scipio already has his core of there's some nutty people out there that absolutely love Scipio. And when I wrote him, you know, he's kind of a scary guy. Me.
No, people
he's,
like
he's
that.
He's an unpredictable
people, but people
guy.
Like that. They like
besides
that.
Besides, he's hot. The other character that you introduced was Salazar, back again. He would work with Michelle Wang. So what, could you tell everybody how he played into this plot? Because that poor guy really...
Well, Salazar, Felix Salazar is actually a... he is only in the Signs of War. I don't know if I have any plans for him in the future. He's not part of the Watchmen. He's a CIA operative who used to work for the character Michelle Wang.
Yes.
So he basically is the guy that comes across it because he was stationed in Venezuela. Out of all the characters that I've written, Felix Salazar has gotten the most negative feedback from people. Absolutely.
Why?
I don't really understand it completely, but even my own wife just said that she doesn't like him. I think it...
They
just don't like him. People were saying that they didn't trust him. Sometimes when you write a character, the way you present a character is not the way that a character is perceived. And Salazar was actually perceived negatively as a guy that shouldn't be trusted. I know a lot of ladies wrote it to me that they didn't like the fact that he used the B word when he was talking about his boss in the CIA. So
yeah, but that's like how it is in, like, you know, in the movies. I mean, that's what it is. You know, if you like every character, there's no story then. You know, you can't, like, you know, then it's a romantic comedy or something. You know what I mean? You're writing real life type of
character. Well, the fact that they give me negative feedback is never a bad thing with the book
because it
just means that the character came alive and people didn't like him.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
I just didn't expect that. I didn't really expect that. I thought I didn't realize that he would be perceived as a guy that, you know, and I see that there's a certain sensitivity to the word, and I can understand it. I mean, you know, if I was a woman, which I'm not, I guess, you know,
but that's what makes people, you know, you can't write the same type of character. And that's what makes people want to read books. And because they just find out different people. And the fact that they're commenting on it means you've done a good job bringing a character to life, even though he's not a great, you know, someone you really...
Hey, listen, I know one of the types of characters that I've never liked in any of the books, and it seems to be in so many thriller novels, is the protagonist is a guy and he's normally married, but he's having marriage problems and he cheats on his wife.
Okay.
And you know, I'm not judging it. I'm just telling you, for me, it's offensive to me that every single man has to be somebody that, you know, if he's a strong male character, of course he's going to cheat on his wife. Well, I wrote, if you see with Chris, he's still battling and his wife is dead. So it's 10 years later and he still hasn't taken his affections away from his wife. And so, you know, I mean, what I'm saying is I guess characters can be, you know, they're perceived
but
by
I think
people
that, I think
in different
that would
ways.
Be that's true life. I think that some people, you know, they are married to somebody and unfortunately the person dies. They don't stop their feelings. You know, they will marry somebody else. I think one of my friends' fathers used to say something, it's just a different chapter in a life of a person, not in a book. You know what I mean? In life, that's how it is. You may always love the person you were first married to, but if they, you know, if they die, you know, you may have another love, but you may have your first love that you remember, and it'll never leave you, and which is not a bad thing.
And Marcia, it's not a bad thing at all. I'm not making a subjective point on it. What I was saying is that there can also be the other kind of guy out there.
Absolutely.
And that's what Chris is. Chris is a guy that's the other kind.
But the thing is, when you're writing characters, this happens. And so I think that people are commenting on it is a good thing, because I think you do a good job when people are discussing your characters.
Yeah, I think next to the bad guy in The Watchmen, Arif Samani, I think Felix Salazar got the most negative feedback for Felix Salazar, which just, I smile because, hey, I'm glad that people even care to write into me and tell me how much they don't like him.
Yeah,
so.
But then, you know what? I read the book twice because I make sure that I read everything twice. You know that. Now,
wow.
Dana is his boss, and she was really not a very, very forthcoming, smart person that didn't allow him to really do his job, because he was just told that he had to stand there and watch the boats and see if the Iranians made port or they, dropped some missiles. So he saw something. And instead of just standing there, he called Michelle Wang, and he decided he was going to do something about it. So, you see, I think they perceive him wrong, because I personally like the guy. I mean, I can understand where in some instances they didn't trust him, because he sort of went off the line, and he sort of, crossed the line. But I think what would have happened, and I'm not going to say anything about what would have happened, if he didn't cross the line, I think the whole end of the book would have been a whole lot different.
Well, yeah, it would have been a whole lot different.
I like him.
I like him. When you write these different opinions, I think it's a great thing when people are actually commenting on characters, because actually that means you brought them to life, and they probably could go on the screen, because that means they become real. And when people are on the screen, sometimes people see reality to them. And that means it's somewhere.
Yeah, and I'm half Spanish, and I if you notice, in a lot of there's a decent percentage of my characters that are different ethnic groups.
Right.
I think that's coming from New York. You grow up in a melting pot, and then being Spanish, I wanted to bring out some positive characters. I'm Italian and Spanish, so all I grew up with were Italians were mafioso in books, and the Spaniards forget about it. I mean, so I wanted to bring out some. But I do try to be real to the way the Spaniards are, and one of them is, Felix is working for women, and there's that macho thing in there, and so Dina was only doing, I think that the character that his boss was only following, what she was being told. The higher you go up in any government agency, I know this for a fact, the more political it becomes, whether it's the military or the different business. So the Dina Main's character would be a person that was listening to her bosses, simple as that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't reacting to it. He didn't seem to have the ability to influence her otherwise. So that's where the B word came out, because
honestly, because as a woman, it isn't that easy. I mean, it really isn't. However, the whatever happens in life, in jobs, is real. I mean, and it does happen to women a lot of times, that we're not taken seriously, or we get lower pay. I mean, it's just life, And so I think when you write characters like that, it's just a part of life. Not that we love it, but it's a part of life.
No doubt.
Well,
and I'm married to I was just going to say, I'm married to a Latina from South Philly who worked her way up from office clerk to CEO now. She runs a company, but she has a very definite, strong, she was the first person to actually edit the book, and she's the first person that turned around and said, I just don't like the character. And I said, well, you mean you don't like the character, you want me to pull it out of the book? That's a little late to be,
You can't.
She said, no, I just mean I don't like him. I don't like him. Yeah. I don't like the way he reacted. And it all had to do with his initial reactions to his boss. So whatever.
A lot of times, like if you're watching something on TV and it's a series, a lot of times people turn on a series and they don't like a character. However, if the series still stays on, then after a while, you sometimes, even in a bad character that's not a good guy, you start to like it. Tony Soprano's one of the best. I mean, that's the best, he started out, people really didn't like him, and then actually people found themselves liking him because he did have some softness to him, okay? And even in a bad character, if they have some softness somewhere, but sometimes that takes a lot, not even a book can finish, that character. Sometimes if it's a series, if they give it a shot. See, sometimes they take a series off like 3 weeks. That's not fair. You have to get to know the person. And it is unfortunate that some tough guys are soft somewhere, which is a good thing if you find it out sometime,
I think women are tougher than men. Look at Fran.
Look at me, it's right. Nobody messes with this little 5 foot person. But you brought in another character. You brought in Felix, and I don't care what anybody says, I thought he was really good. I like bad characters. That's, you know what? I'm different. I told you, and I stand by what I said. The other character was involved in the kidnapping was Brian. And why did you bring him in? You had a lot of characters that I had to remember.
Yeah, Brian. So, Brian, it was the head of the Shadow Wolves, which is a real ICE. They're Border Patrol agents that are located on the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation, which borders the Mexico Arizona border. And so the Shadow Wolves are just I actually read an article about them a year ago as I was writing The Watchmen, and I was just so I said, you know, a book has to be written about these guys because they use traditional Native American tracking tactics in order to track. They use some of the high tech, but they really use the old Native American traditional ways of tracking the illegal immigrants that utilize the nation to get into the United States. And the plot took me there, and then I said, well, you know, they're going to be part of this. This story, and Brian is modeled after one of their is actually modeled after one of their leaders down there, real charismatic leader that they had, and Brian just came back because the story is still down there, and Brian is kind of a beloved character, so you know I will tell you that I am influenced by when people write in and tell me the characters that they like. I mean, I won't specifically go out of my way to change the plot line, but if there's enough interest in the character and it fits into the plot, certainly they're gonna come up.
Yeah. I think you should bring Felix back, and the heck with what everybody else thinks, because I think he's really got personality.
I think he's got
fortitude.
He might find something good to say. He might find something later, something good that he does.
Do you want to know the
I was going to say the other character that is not liked, universally not liked, and I'm going by gender here because I keep all the responses.
Yeah.
Is Dr. Mariah Stevens. The women do not like that character at all. They don't like her.
She doesn't have a I could see why.
They don't like her around Chris and I guess
let's put it this way. It's a well-rounded book because you've got a lot of different characters.
Okay? Yeah, lots of characters.
That's not a bad thing. You know, I write with a lot of characters too. Some people don't like that. I do. That's just how I write. You know, to me it makes it very interesting when you have a lot of characters and then you get a lot of, you know, you can find out a lot of things about them and you have time in a book. And in a script, you have to do it really quick. But I
no,
do
it
like
makes
a lot
for
of
a
characters.
Terrible screenplay.
Yeah. Well, that's not true.
Too many
that's
characters.
Not really because that's what they say. Because I like a movie that has more than two or three characters because it gives it a lot of life. You know, and it's hard to watch a screen for 90 minutes or 2 hours with just two people. I mean, sometimes it can work wonderfully, but most times they need to have some, like I'm always saying, so where's this one? Why did they not put that one back? You know, because sometimes they need more than just two people on a set.
You know what? I think if you're from New York, I grew up in an apartment building that probably had 60 people in the building, you know, and it was just a three-floor apartment building. So I think when you're from New York, I found it kind of normal to have this many people around, and I have had people, you know, write, to me also that, you know, you have an awful lot of characters in your
book.
I don't go out of my way to write them. It's just that's the way the story comes to me, and that's how it plays out in my mind.
You know, and when I write, I'm from Chicago, so that could be, too, because people always say, like, why do you write with, like, a limo in it? Why do you write with people on the street having hot dogs? I go, because this is Chicago, you know, and I see people like that. You know, this is not unusual. I just wrote it, you know.
You put ketchup on your hot dogs
in
Chicago? I hope you don't put ketchup on your hot dogs in Chicago.
I don't eat hot dogs, but my characters usually on Michigan Avenue. And it was funny that I named my company Michigan Avenue Media because I did a lot of my screenplays are – you know, they're right on Michigan Avenue because I love that street. I just think it's so much could happen there. And it's, you know, but people, right, it's if you're from a city like you are and I am, that you write a lot. Sometimes it happens, you know. You write a lot of people. And somebody once said in a screenplay to me, they said, if you're writing a character in a screenplay and you write like, oh, doctor, you need to give him a name because everybody should have a name. And it always stuck in my mind that it makes them so unimportant if they don't have a name. So sometimes I go, instead of like red-haired person, you'll write like you give a name. you know, and I think that that's what they said. And I guess it means something when you name somebody. And
well, you name somebody, it makes it it allows you to become more personal, more intimate with the character.
Like,
one of the things my wife does not like, again, my editor, she doesn't like the nicknames that I give everybody. But that, again, comes from my background. And,
yeah.
You know,
oh, I like
Chris De Niro and I have the same background. So I know, you know, I mean, everybody in Brooklyn has a nickname. Everybody. Every guy, anyway. And, you know, so she's like, you know, I get confused. You have so many names. You call him Rigoni, Riggy, and, Pestilitis is Pesky.
I get in real life. Right. In real life, my friends, we still call each other, you know, the names that we called each other, you know, all our lives. You know, it's a nickname. We just do it. You know?
Yeah, but you write it enough times that you explain who they are each, you know, time, the brother-in-law, the cousin, the aunt, and then, of course, if I'm reviewing the book, I take a piece of paper and a pencil and write down the names and who they are so that I don't forget or spell them wrong, because I've been noted to do that also. so at the end, everybody knows that. What can I tell you? You created the sequence of events for the pirate siege and attacks. And how did you learn about computer hacking? How did you put that stuff in? That's
well,
I always get fascinated about that. I love that.
You know, I have such an unusual background. Sometimes I listen to myself and say, you know what, I should have been a character, you know, if I was in another life, I should be a character. Because I really don't follow the path that a lot of people did, you know. I had so many different backgrounds. One of the things I do is I have an IT degree. So I knew a lot about it. I hate to say hacking, but I know a lot about computers. And as far as the whole piracy thing. Mm-hmm. I actually read a bunch of articles on some of the hostage taking, on some of the things that happened, and I put it together so that it was very, very accurate. Yeah, I love putting, you know, with a thriller, to me it brings it alive. I think I learned that kind of from Tom Clancy. I actually was fooled when Clancy wrote The Hunt for Red October. I actually thought the Red October was out there somewhere. That's how good he was.
Yeah.
So that's what I try to do.
Yeah,
you have your definite
better
style, and it's a good style. You add characters, and that's a good thing. And, you know, you're a good writer. So, that, I mean, you know, that's really what it boils down to. People are reading your books. And we probably should talk about some of these other things, you know, about your life.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, because, I mean, everybody knows you as a writer, but like I asked you when I talked to you, can we talk about certain things? So I would like to talk about a certain thing, because I do always tell people, you know, if something bad happens in your life, you have to move on and go on and try to have the best life you can. And something did happen bad in your life. Do you want to discuss that a little so people can realize that you're coming from a lot of different places?
I don't know if it's bad. It's just something that happens to me. I was diagnosed with cancer back in 1996, and it wasn't something that I expected. I went in for cosmetic surgery. I was a single guy at the time and had a lump on my neck, and went in there and said, hey, can you take this thing, you know, can you get this thing off? And the doctor at the time didn't think it was a big thing. He says he thought it was just a benign tumor and not a big deal, 15-minute operation. And they keep you open for an extra 15 minutes, as he told me, just to do a pathology on it. And 99 times out of 100, you're fine. Well, I was the one. So if you're ever wondering about the one, I'm the one out of the 100.
Yeah, right.
And I found out that I had lymphoma. I had Hodgkin's disease, and I was diagnosed with a very specific subtype. But I have to tell you that, you know, what happens to you in life is, you know, we all have our different experiences. It's
right.
How you react to them that, you know, I think is the whole purpose for existence anyway. So it absolutely changed my life profoundly, and I was already 33 years old when I was, you know, Hodgkin's disease mostly hits males in their young 30s. So I was the archetypical guy to get hit with it, and it was in a very bad place up by my brainstem, so it was a little unusual. So it ended my music career, and it basically left me with a whole different perspective on life. So, and it was a good perspective, because everything that has happened to me, the best things that have happened to me in my life have started happening 4 days after the last radiation, including that's when I met my wife. So
wow.
It just goes to show you that you know,
out of the
worst circumstances, the best things can happen.
Exactly. That's why I asked if we could talk about that, because sometimes, you know, when someone is, it might be listening and they're, you know, not feeling well, and they realize that you have started a whole new life after that, which is a good thing, because some people choose to just, you know, not do anything else afterwards, and that's really great that you've done everything you've done, and certainly now that you've met your wife, you know, naturally it's a wonderful thing. So that's a good thing. You know,
yeah,
it took
a couple of years to get back on my feet, because not really from the cancer, because when they put the cancer in remission, then okay, but the radiation regimen I had was a very new one because of the subtype of cancer that I had, and it was very, very bad on my body. I still have lingering effects from that. So that's really what ended my musical career. I couldn't physically do what I needed to do in order to keep the career going. So I met my wife literally my first words to her is, "You're not catching me at my best."
Yeah, right.
Which was not lying.
Right. Yeah,
so, you know.
Right. But I think it's lasted. You have four kids now. So how old are your boys?
Isn't that a joke? You know, I could tell you another joke about that. Okay, now you have radiation. You're supposed to be sterile. I had full mantle radiation. I was told that there's no way to have kids. At the time, I wasn't married. It wasn't a big thing on my mind.
Right.
But, you know, I got married 4 months later. I only dated my wife about three times before I married her.
Really?
So. So my wife, I told my wife, I said, listen, you know, I want you to understand, I can't have children. And, you know, South Philly and her came up, and she says, we'll deal with that when it comes. Well, when it came, she didn't deal with it very well. She said, you know, I don't understand this. We're going to have to go to a fertility doctor. And I said, you know, Lisa, I explained this to you.
Right.
But
which happened,
you know what?
God
has a sense of humor, because even if you can have a child, if you've been hit with radiation, to have a male child is very, very it's rare. I had four, so she kept sending photos to my oncologist,
right.
And finally, when the last one was born, my oncologist actually called from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I was living out in Vegas by then, and he said, you know, she was on the phone. He says, get your husband on the phone. He didn't even say hello.
Right.
So I get on the phone, and he says, okay, I got it.
Right.
I was wrong.
Right. Right.
So I just thought that was kind of a,
well,
you know, that,
you
that's
know
my
it's
life.
Also good, it's also good for him to know that, because then you're a proven commodity, like, you know what I mean, that it's worked out for you. So that's a good thing. I think.
Oh, yeah, it was good, and it's just her South Philly way to say, you know, you know, she did, as a matter of fact, they're best friends now, but I just thought it was hilarious when this doctor wrote back.
Right.
He says, okay,
right.
I got it, I was wrong, stop sending me photos.
Well, they don't like to hear that they're wrong sometimes. That's the other
thing. No.
that is true. That is true. So are you homeschooled? Because I've talked about that a lot on other shows. You have a homeschool. Why did you decide to do that? That's unusual.
That is nuts.
Yeah.
That is really what it is. Actually, it came because we're Judeo-Christians. My wife and I kind of follow the Bible. So there's not very large congregations. And so, you know, anywhere. Actually, in New York and in the East, there are. But when you move around, and my wife and I have moved around with our careers, sometimes it's very difficult to find people of the same faith. So I said, you know, I'd like to center their upbringing on our faith, and you know, school is a big part of that. But keep in mind, though, I went to Catholic school. I was raised a Catholic, and I went to St. Francis Prep, fantastic school in New York, and so I came from, you know, I'm traditional. The homeschooling to me sounded like dirty feet people, hippies hanging out in a park somewhere. It was my progressive hippie, born in 69 wife that was saying, you know, hey, we can do this, and we'll take it 1 year at a time, and it's been 12 years now. So I'm very, very, very pleased with the way it's turned out.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, all right, that's good. You know, and there's another, you mentioned about your music career, so I think people might like to know what you did before, because you were very successful. You had a really good career going.
Yes, I was in a band. I was a musician for forever, and I ended up doing TV commercials. You know, no better city in the world to be a musician than in New York. Okay, because there's so many opportunities, and I started very young. I actually read music before I read English. I was privately tutored, a classical trumpet player. And so we came out of that, and there just wasn't enough girls being attracted to classical trumpet players. So I think I switched over and said I want to be a rock and roll musician. And my older brother Peter and I started a band named Americade, and this is going all the way back to 1979. And we came out kind of like a Chicago at first. We were kind of like a jazz rock band with we still had the trumpets in it. And then I experienced this band Van Halen, and I saw how much fun they were having with just four people instead of eight people on stage, and I floated over to become a guitar player. I actually taught myself guitar in a year, and yeah, we came out and we made a lot of noise, as they would say, being a heavy metal band back in those days.
So do you miss it at all, or are you?
I'm still, you know, friendly with all my bandmates, I think I like to play, but I didn't like the lifestyle, and it was kind of hard on me from 81 until 84, where we were, it was just it's a hard lifestyle, and I give it to anybody that can do it.
You wouldn't be able to get much writing in. That's for sure.
Yeah, and my favorite part of music was writing. I was also, I worked at the same time. Right around the same time, my dad owned a manufacturing plant, and I floated over and was very enamored from the time I was a little boy with the engineer, with inventing and building machinery. So you can see that my personality is one to want to create. Whether it was music or whether it was machinery or whether now, it's the books are absolutely, this is what I've always wanted to do. I just didn't know it. That's when I'm happiest. Everything else to me is secondary. Most rock musicians want to do it because you have the fans, and we have great fans even to this day. We're re-releasing a 30-year box set, 5-CD box set. It's just coming out now, and we have great fans that have
now,
I mean, 30 years. We have fans 30
are you
years.
You're going to mention that on your website at all? People wanted to buy it, or
it's actually mentioned already, I'm waiting for the CDs to be printed. The president of the record company, a guy named Aaron McCaslin, great guy and a younger fellow, but he was a big fan of the band. And the pre-sales on it, what I did is I said, hey, put a coupon in there, and I'm going to allow discounts for the books in the thing and see if I can let some of the fans know doing. Yeah, so it's working out real well.
That's really good. Do you want to say your website so we don't forget that? We should probably do that.
It is my name. It's GerardDeMarini.com, and good luck trying to spell it, but if you type in Gerard, D-E-M-A-R-I-G-N-Y, it's a French name. You'll see it come up there. You know what? Better? Just Google Signs of War. That's easy to remember, and you should see my name come up.
You know what I wanted to also ask you? On your video, I happened to watch that when the two Frenchmen did the documentary.
Right.
You're talking about the
Frenchmen that did the documentary of the 9/11.
That was unreal. That was so
Oh,
my God. Want to talk a little bit about that? Because that was so unreal.
I just talked for the first time 2 days ago. I talked to the wife of our friend Danny Affolito, who died. Stacy Affolito is my wife's best friend, and she called in 2 days ago. The book originally was going to be dedicated to him, and after I started writing it, I didn't. I'm always trying to be sensitive to, it's kind of a personal thing, I didn't, I ended up dedicating it to all the friends and families of victims of 9/11. But honestly, Stacy,
that was a nice thing.
I can't even talk about it now because it makes me get a little emotional. But I was there with Stacy the moment that her husband called, my friend Danny called, and after the plane hit. So it was a big thing. And you know what? I sent her the book, and I called her the day it came out, because I didn't want her to find out about it from other friends or whatever. And I never got to explain to her that the storyline in the first two chapters are very close. I mean, Stacy, there's a character, Stacy, that's friends with the character Lisa, Chris's wife, and that's why they end up on the 104th floor, which is where Danny worked in Cantor Fitzgerald. And so we had all these things, and I never got a chance. And you know what? She called me 2 days ago, and she said, Gerard, I never got around to reading The Watchmen, and when I saw Sons of War came out, I started reading it, and she had been crying the whole day. But
I
it was a good
chills.
Cry.
I got,
she
I got
was
the
very
myself because it's very emotional for her, I'm sure.
She was very, yeah. And I was, I said, Stacey, you know, we never had the conversation. I wanted to explain to you that, you know, what to expect. And she said, no, it's excellent. This is great. And it was, it turned out to be exactly how I wanted it to be. Where
that was right there.
You know, yeah.
Because I think actually Robert De Niro, he was the he narrated it at the beginning, you know,
yeah.
of the, for the, and it was really very well done. And they were just doing a documentary just to do one. They had no idea what they were going to see.
You know what? You try to do research for a novel. You know,
yep.
You write, Marcia, and you
yep.
know how it is. So I'm looking for what I needed to find is I wanted as close to the actual event at the World Trade Center as I
and
could get.
Was,
I read some books on it. I mean,
yep.
there's some pretty good books on it. But that video, literally, just because they were there.
Yep.
I studied that thing for 6 weeks. It was the worst 6 weeks of my life having to relive that incident.
Well, I think they
over
were two Frenchmen. I think people might not know what that was, and I think it's out. They were doing this like an assignment for themselves. You know, they wanted to see how you know what went on in fires, and they had no idea that this was going to happen. And that's really how it got on film. It was.
They were actually doing a documentary
yeah.
on the New York Fire Department
yeah.
that was
yeah.
closest to the World Trade Center. And they just happened to be there when, and you couldn't believe it. It was almost too much to believe that they were standing outside, one
right.
of the two brothers with the cameraman,
yeah.
when the first plane flew overhead. So
they
it was,
had no
it,
idea,
it,
and it's a really, it's an incredible documentary. I don't actually know the name of it, but it was, it probably wouldn't be too hard to find
it.
If people look it up, but it was really, really good, you know, and I think it was actually a documentary, and they didn't have any commercials. It was a commercial-free show. So I
yes.
think it was, yeah, it was really very good. And Robert De Niro, he just narrated it at the beginning because he's very involved in, you know, in New York. That's
oh, not Robert De Niro, Chris De Niro.
Right. Well, no, but
right.
Robert De Niro was the one that did it, but Robert De Niro's very New York. You know, he is New York.
Yes, he is.
Yes. And
absolutely.
So So it was, you know, I mean, all these things, you know, that got you where you are. So you are at a good place right now. You've done two books that are really good. What's next?
Rise to the Call. It's book
okay.
three in the series, and it's, you know, Chris De Niro is going to go home in this one. So he's going to go back to New York. And I have some very interesting, very excited about getting to this book. It, you know, most counterterrorism techno thrillers rely heavily on very, very large events. And, you know, there's a nuclear threat in the first book and the missiles in the second book. And this book also has something else that's playing out right now, scary, but it's playing out right now. And, you know, my style of writing is to have more than one thing happening, and so there's going to be a couple things happening. But I'm just kind of I'm excited to take Chris, you know, back to his roots, and you know, that's where the story actually springs from.
And Fran will be ready to review it. Fran, are you there? Fran,
I'm here.
By the way,
I'm
I just
here.
Want to say the name of that video is 9/11. It's
okay.
actually called 9/11.
Okay.
You can pull
okay.
it up
okay.
on you know.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so people are out there listening. It's 9/11. Okay, that's
yep.
No, I'm ready to read it. Don't worry. And how many plots am I going to have to remember? And are we going to include any? And are we going to include any new characters, or are we going to stick with what we already have?
Well,
there's another
name in the. He's it's a name familiar in Brooklyn, but he's the fellow that the plot. Revolves around one part of the plot revolves around, but you know some of these characters are not recurring characters as much as they're just the, you know, as the Watchmen and Chris De Niro go through their life and their activities. This is where they go, and so there are certain characters like Salazar and the character that's going to come up that you know they pop up and they probably won't pop up in other in the rest of the series. So So.
Well, if you're going to include Dr. Maura Stevens, she's going to have some more gumption. She's going to have to be a little bit tougher.
Yeah.
And she's going to have to stand up. Because she's kind of, you know, she's okay. And I realize that the kids accept her, but that's kind of like, you know, most kids wouldn't accept anybody, but they finally did. But she's going to have to get a little bit more gutsy, and she's going to have, she really wants Chris, she's going to have to fight for him. Otherwise, a little competition would be good. You never know.
You know what? I've been getting a lot of pressure to see if there's, you know, that, you know, people realizing that Chris De Niro is one of the richest men in the world. He's, you know, he's still a middle-aged guy. He's a good-looking guy, and you know, I, you know, so they want me to progress. They just, you know, a lot of people say, listen, you know, this guy is going to be, you know, one of the most desirable men. He's also a guy that doesn't, he's not in the spotlight. He doesn't like the spotlight, so that kind of saves him from it. And I don't know what's going to happen with Mariah and him, but you know, who knows? He may meet somebody else.
That's right. You never know. You got to write it, and then you'll know. That's the thing.
That's right.
That is what happens. I think that people sometimes think that all writers, I've heard so many writers say the same thing, that sometimes they're making it one way and it just turns another way, and that, you know, as writers we understand that because, you know, sometimes they do, I think they come alive, and I think they should. And so when they do, they just always don't do it exactly the way we might do it, but they do it, you know. I mean, when people write books, though, it's not a reflection on them. It took me a long time to get that in my head, that what I wrote wasn't everything I thought. It was my characters. And so for me, it was
absolutely
a little difficult. You know, when I first started, I was thinking, oh, well, they think I'm going to say this or that. And it really is my characters. It's not anything. And I don't have any characters that have been me. You know, then because that I can tell you, because most of my characters are doing like one thing instead of 20 at one time. But, so, you know, but I mean, like you said, too, I do a lot of things, too, and I have done a lot of things. And that is why I like a lot of characters. It just happens. You know, some people just write like that. You know, and I don't think it's a bad thing, right? Yeah, no, it is. And some people just take a few people, and they can make it really very interesting. You know.
Yeah,
I think that ultimately
you got to put yourself in it. You know, you got to put your own. That's what makes it. That's what can really make it come alive. That's why formula. I don't believe in formula writing at all. You know, you get a group of people and you tell them to all write in a certain style, and what you're doing is you're making it generic and pulling out the personal aspect.
Right. Right.
You know, who wants that?
Right. I
so
do.
How much of you is Chris De Niro?
We come from the same neighborhood.
My dad came from Williamsburg.
Yeah, there you go. So, trust me, there's a ton of people that love seeing a kind of a righteous character come out of Brooklyn or come out of New York. Because, you know, Tony Soprano aside. Yeah, I mean, Tony Soprano aside, and, you know, we don't really have too many strong figures. Every time somebody comes out of Brooklyn, it's a story about a crime, you know, a cop that turned bad, and this and that and the other thing. And, you know, it's about time that we have a kind of a righteous, strong character that also is a New Yorker. I mean, there's no doubt that De Niro acts like an Italian from Brooklyn. As cultured as he is, running a hedge fund, ultimately, when you threaten, you know, his family or his friends or the United States, he's going to react, I think, in a way that most New Yorkers would find very
right. And I think it's
normal.
A showing he's very American. That's what he is, you know, above all.
It's his version of American. Yeah.
Right,
It's a New York version of American.
Well, but every you know what, since doing these shows, and I'm sure Fran and I'm sure Sanders, you know, who's listening to, we're all here, that we've met so many different people, and we are from different parts, and everybody is different. We view things differently because we came from different worlds, all of us.
Yep.
You know, I came in Chicago, a lot of people from L.A., Utah, wherever, and Missouri, you know, Detroit. I mean, there are people that we've done shows with everywhere, Indiana. And so we are all different. And I didn't realize how much, even in our writing styles. Fran, wouldn't you agree that you could always tell that we're different? I mean, don't you think that when we're writing?
Well, they think I'm really different. What can I tell you? I come from the Bronx. I grew up in the South Bronx, so it got kind of tough. And you had to be kind of tough. And I don't live there anymore. I just moved. I'm so excited. And
congratulations.
I finally moved. My father was a dry cleaner, and he was tough. and we were his store was in a tough neighborhood in the Bronx, and I used to work there on Saturdays because I had no choice, because working was just like you did. You didn't have a vacation on the weekend. So, yeah, you know, everybody is different. Everybody's style is different. And I guess when I wrote my Bertha series, All About Me, yeah, it sort of came out that I came from the Bronx and all the things that happen when you grow up in the South Bronx. So, you know, your background in Brooklyn, my dad, like I said, I grew up in Williamsburg. My grandmother grew up on Mulberry Street, and she gave birth in the house. So, you know, you grow up kind of different. And Marcia's from Chicago, but she's more like New York. Yeah. And I don't eat hot dogs either, ever.
No.
But that's not because it was because I just don't.
Everybody thinks I'm from New York. Everybody does
Nathan's is still the best. What can I tell you?
You know what? The best aspects of reading novels, you know, fiction, is I think, you know, I remember a young boy being in Brooklyn, but reading Mark Twain, and you're reading about a man from the South, and so and then reading Jack London and reading about Alaska. And, you know, that to me, it's by putting those flavors in, you knew that these authors, you know, dramatized their own experiences. I think that makes it come alive, you know.
I think that's true. I mean, because all the people that we've met over, you know, even the 2 years I've been doing this for all the shows, and it really is great because I'm actually, they're writing things, but it's coming more to life because I know them, and sometimes I can hear their voice in their stories. So, I mean, I think it's very interesting to learn about different people. I've always liked that. And now I really am learning about it. Because that's wherever we have a show, everybody's different. I don't think anybody's been exactly the same that I've had on. Wouldn't you agree, Fran? I mean, everybody we meet is different.
We're gonna have you know, a lot of different people next month. At least I am, and Marcia is also. And I've got people from all over the world. I've got an author from England coming on in January, and I never know where anybody is from until I get the area code. Until Sandra says to me, "Could you send me the area code so we figure out where they're coming from?" Yeah, we've had people from England and people from Israel and people from everywhere. And, you know, of course, you're from Nevada, right?
Yeah.
I'm living out in a suburb of Las Vegas,
Las Vegas, which I've never been to. My sister, before she died, she went there. She loved going
there. You'd like it. You'd like it there.
I like going around the corner. Anywhere would be nice, but, you know, now that we moved, but the farthest I get to is the bagel place. And you know what's really bad? The Bronx and Brooklyn, and I'm sure Chicago, they deliver people. Up where I am, they don't deliver. I lost 10 pounds since I moved here when I'm skinny enough.
No, they don't deliver. They don't deliver. They do not deliver like
you
think. No, because you want your breakfast. If Fran used to get her breakfast, her oatmeal.
Delivered every morning at 7:30, And they called me if I didn't call.
No, I don't
and
have,
now I have
nobody. Nobody is delivering oatmeal. If I'm going to have oatmeal, I'm making it. Nobody's delivering
they deliver my oatmeal. What can I say?
All right, well, Gerard, you're a great guest. We love having you on, because, you know, you're not only a good writer, you're just, you know, and that's why I wanted people to know a little bit about you, because there's a lot more to you than just writing a book. So, Fran does the book, and I like to find out about the person inside, you know, because I think we all, as writers, like to know about, you know, something about the people that are authors. And Sandra here? I don't know if she's still here. Sandra?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. Is there anybody that wanted to ask any questions out there? I'm not looking at the chat room right now.
No, we don't have any questions in the chat room.
Okay, all right. Okay, because we probably covered everything. Between Fran and I, there's nothing going like, okay, fine.
I want to thank both of you ladies. Fran and Marcia have been outstanding to help, you know, an unknown author like me. Fran was one of the first people to reach out to me when I wrote The Watchmen, and since then it's been all good.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Marcia,
yeah.
you put me right on in for this opportunity to talk to you.
Well, we love to have you. We'll have you anytime you want, you know. And you weren't on any of my crazy shows yet. Well, you were on one that just had four. Sandra was on the show with me. We had 10 guests, and that was a little – I think I pushed a little too far.
I didn't like it because I didn't hear Fran. Fran didn't talk that much on the last one, so that's not my Fran.
Fran wasn't on the show.
You were on the show. The other one with four people, you know. But Fran does, you know, one-on-one, you know. I know. And a lot of times my show, she doesn't come on because they're too late. Sandra has been with me. A lot of these shows.
I'm going to be on a show.
We should have a show on Sandra. You know, there's a lot of people I think that
Sandra
want to find out more about Sandra's writing.
Sandra
That's
is
right.
going to be on, and I pushed her. I just this time I'm not sick. I'm letting her relax because I do push her on my shows. I do, and she's getting her book published. Sandra, do you want to say about how many months is it going to be for your book out to come out?
March.
Good. Okay. Well, then, you know what? It's turning fast, and she's going to come on, and I will interview her.
Yeah, and I want more than one word answers, Sandra. You can't give us just March.
Yeah.
Hey,
she's writing.
I'm
she's got a lot of stories. Well, listen, how many stories do you have going? She's got, listen, how many? Go ahead.
Me?
Yeah.
Now I'm 14.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
God
you
bless.
You should hear on my show the other day, people have 45 stories, 30 stories. I'm thinking, like, I don't know. I thought I was writing a lot and doing a lot. And they're going, like, oh, I have 30 stories. I mean, I couldn't believe how many stories people are starting at one time. You know, and I, you know, yeah. But, you know, usually when I write, I like to stick with one thing. You know, that's what I do when I'm writing. You know, but Sandra's, listen, we had a romance show, and to show everybody that there's so many different kinds of romance, the same with mystery, thriller. So I think people have to open up their mind and just, you know, try reading. And certainly with the Kindle, how do you feel about the Kindle? I know you're liking it, Gerard.
I love the Kindle.
Yeah, I
do. About 70% of my...
Yeah.
Of my sales are now on Kindle. That started around June, and it's Amazon is. I know Fran's had the problems with Amazon, and I hate to hear that because she's such a great reviewer, and people need to read her reviews. But
I
you
think,
know, Barnes and Noble,
mm-hmm.
Barnes and Noble is starting to pick up. The Nook sold about a million pieces this year in 11, so it's still there. It's still something to be, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, and I'm actually going to have on my website Barnes & Noble. I'm going to put that on, and because my books are on Barnes & Noble, but everybody just says Amazon, but, you know, Barnes & Noble, all of us want to go for book signings, and I think that if we support Barnes & Noble, hopefully they'll support the writers, you know, and I think that might work for everybody because everybody does want to go. And as authors, I think that would be great if they have a lot more authors because people like to meet authors.
I'll also tell you this, though. Remember, you know, I'm selling in about 85 countries right now. So the outside of the United States, Kindle is not nearly as possible, or even ebook isn't as possible. So about 4 out of 10 sales that I make still are in paper. So you know that
so how
goes
you, like,
without
I,
saying.
I'm having on. I think in January that we're going to talk about. You know, see overseas and how people are selling. How did you get involved in that before we go? How did you get?
When you put the book out, the books are distributed through Ingram, through Lightning Source. And,
which is mine,
you know,
too.
With the, people
which
can buy the books in brick and mortars all over the world. And I have a lot of people from England and down in Australia has been a big market for me. I've been very pleased. I think they're very similar to us as people. Also, I didn't do any translation yet. I just got contacted by a German publisher saying they'd be interested in getting the rights and translating it. That's something that authors should look into. It's costly, but if your book does get traction overseas, the markets over there are easy to crack if you have translated novels.
Yeah. Well, Fran, you're putting a lot on UK now, right? You're putting on Amazon UK.
Well,
UK?
They haven't. Yeah, I've been doing it on Amazon UK so far. They've been, you know, there's no problem.
And there's so many.
Really
there are so
there.
Many different countries and different things that we probably should all look into.
I'm going to try Japan and China next and see what happens. But it's ridiculous that they actually think
Japan
I
and China are hard
interview.
Because we can't get the books into China. Japan, believe it or not, I have a huge band fan club that's still there.
Really?
Vibrant music scene, but as far as the readers, I'm not getting the readers. I have a lot more in South America, and I'm having that's also a market that's hard to get the books down there. So they're going to have to ultimately order from Amazon or from Barnes & Noble and then have the book shipped, and that there's just nothing you can't get around. I can't get around it as a small publisher.
I'm going to see one of those sites and see if the reviews on there are in English or in Japanese or Chinese, because I have something on my computer that I could actually translate my review into another language.
Yeah, they have that now. Right. They do have that now.
Yeah,
and
I know how to do
that.
I think
we should probably look into those things. I'll probably be looking into those things, too, because I think that's really good to share around the world how great that would be. So I think that's a good
thing. Yeah, I could put my review, if they take the review in Japanese or Chinese, I have this thing and I could just translate it. I did that for Eva Etzioni from Israel. I translated her reviews in English to Hebrew. She was able. Yeah, I did. It took me 5 minutes to do that. I can do it. Well, I should be able to do it without the translator. But yeah, I can translate it into almost anything. And if they'll take the whole review, I could just put it in there and put it back and then put it on another site.
Yeah.
But yeah, Amazon UK, so far so good.
Yeah. We'll try for
site.
Others. I mean, I do think there's so many other sites. I really do.
Yeah, lunch.com is equal to Amazon, if not better.
I'm going to go on there.
They read everything I write, and they comment about it. They haven't missed one review. I put three on this morning for three books I read just yesterday, and there's a comment every single time I write, and it's always nice. It's well written. It's well crafted. You know what you're doing. And you thank you. There's somebody else who I'm writing.
Well, it's nice
they
to hear
everything.
That.
And it's rare to hear it. Yeah,
well, it's nice.
It's rare.
Very
it's nice to hear something nice other than how much do you charge, which is, of course, people is nothing.
Right.
So the book is coming out in April,
right?
We'll
just say that before we go. You do not charge for book reviews.
I have never.
No,
I
just for anybody else to know, Fran Lewis approached me because she saw the book through Book Pleasures, and she was nice enough to reach out to me. Never asked for anything. I think that's absolutely a ridiculous allegation. Bottom line, Fran, you're a great reviewer. You got a lot of passion, and people, readers need to see the authors need you, but the readers also need you. So don't, you know.
Yes, because the readers need her because she's writing a review, and certainly her reviews are long, and they can be used as synopsises. They can be used as a lot of things. So it's not just a review. It's a lot of things. I even had her do a screenplay for me, you know, to get to the nitty, because a lot of times you write a screenplay. You have to, when you do a screenplay, it's very hard to figure out what is this story about exactly, because you have one sentence that you can use as a log line. So it's pretty difficult. So that's why Fran does that also. But she does not charge. And so I think that, you know, I think that'll it'll blow over because it wasn't true. So, you know, and sometimes things happen and it wasn't true. So I think
somebody hacked into my website and put something on my website on my blog that I have a review package or something.
Yeah.
And when I took it off, Amazon, the CEO, emailed me and said, you know, you took it off. I did because I didn't put it there. But it's not hard to hack into somebody's anything.
Yeah.
So I looked at it and I looked at it and go like, how did that get there? Well, I don't charge. And there's no disclaimer.
It's pretty tough
on
now. You can, knowing people can hack in, and knowing people are stealing things on the internet. They are taking stories and putting it out as their own. It had to happen because this is an open market, and people do things and they're not right.
You know, Amazon went on
it.
My website. For this, about 150,000 people that review or put reviews on, and of all the people in the world, they found my reviews and my website because I had over 400 of them on there. They probably just didn't realize that I read fast. Yeah, well, I'm not the one that's getting hurt. It's the authors and it's the readers and it's their sales because, sometimes your sales go up when you, have my reviews. So
well, it's difficult enough to get, when you start to get a review or to even read the book and to have, and I'll tell you something else. There are a lot of paid for reviews out there, and publishers know and authors know it's a fact of life. Some of them have come out and just said, "Listen, I personally think it would be unethical to do that. I mean, the whole point of it is to give readers the opportunity to get a fair and balanced view of the book and." That can only come from another reader. I mean, and I'm not talking about professional reviews. Even on professional reviews, there are companies out there that Amazon's fully aware of that charge for the reviews, and they give the author the ability that, hey, if it's a bad review, you don't even have to post it. So, I mean, they're out there. You could Google it, and you'll come up with 10 pages of review pay for review sites.
Yeah.
The fact is, Fran.
In some ways, though, I don't really think if you did pay for a review, I don't actually think that the reviewer, because, would write just a good review because you paid them. I just sometimes feel like they work so hard, and
I come from the financial industry, still have licenses and stuff, and I think that, ethics is fine. So all you have to do is say it. And let me put it this way. When I give a book out to a friend, if you look at the review, the review says, hey, I received this book from Gerard for free. Good, that's fine. That allows the readers to understand, hey, This is how I came by the book. I don't see anything wrong with if somebody said, "Listen, this publisher, this author, paid for us to review this the book, and then wrote the review." I would read it just as much
as
that. You know,
a lot of times, like in Fran's case, she reviews very fast. Okay, and she reads every word. Okay, now, if some reviewers take a long time, so some of those reviewers do charge, because if you want it first, I mean, Fran reads fast, but most people do not read that fast. So if you
Like Evelyn Wood's sister. Yeah. She can read 90,000 words nothing flat. So.
That's right.
Want to know how I decide. Do you? It's a book with the least amount of pages.
Well, that's what we do. Listen, in Hollywood,
the whole story is out of the question with you, Fran.
In Hollywood, they kind of like they skim over the script, and if you've got too much description, they don't want that either. So, right, it's few words. That's the thing. We know that. All right. On that note, I want everybody that I will certainly have a good holiday and a good holiday season. We have a show though on Tuesday, and. Sarah Paretsky will be with us, 5:30 Central, 6:30. And all three of us will be here. Sandra will be here, Fran and myself, and 6:30 Eastern. So thank you. And Gerard, thank you so much, and good luck with your book and every project that you're doing. And we love your characters, and you're a good writer. Just keep going.
Thanks so much, Marcia. Thank you, Fran, and thanks, everybody.
You're welcome.
Everybody had a good time listening in.
We did. Okay, take care. Bye.
Talk to you later.
Bye. See you Tuesday. Bye.